Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
It's the early 1980s, and somewhere inside a Japanese manufacturer's headquarters, the lights are still on, long after the offices have emptied. Spread across a table are blueprints, rule books, and race calendars from places on the other side of the world. Rally racing in Finland, touring cars in Australia, endurance races designed to destroy your chassis and break your spirit. Manufacturers around Japan are all asking themselves the same question. Could our cars win? Whether they were ready for it or not, they were about to find the answer, because a decade full of innovation is coming to a close, and with the 90s just around the corner, Japan is in a position to seize the moment. And not only do they catch up to the rest of the world, they leave everyone behind. Hello, welcome back to Past Gas. It's episode 6 of the Golden Age of JDM. Here we are. It's time to go racing, people. That's the theme of today's episode. We're hitting the track in a major way. Everybody's hopping in. And we're gonna see some pretty iconic cars. We're gonna hear about some pretty iconic racing moments in this episode. The previous episodes up to this point have kind of been setting the stage, you know, really laying all that groundwork, giving you all the context. We love context around here at Past Gas. And now we're in it. We are now officially in the Golden Age. This is the stuff that games like Gran Turismo, you know, really celebrate here. We are now talking about the cars that you probably imagine when you hear the term the Golden Age of JDM. So, very exciting stuff. Enough of me talking. Let's get right into it. It's fitting that the opening shot was fired not on a dirt rally stage in Finland or a banked oval at Daytona, but on the Formula One grid. Honda had entered Formula One in 1965 and lasted just one season with pretty mixed results, with their most successful race being in Mexico, where they took first place. They re-entered Formula One in 1983 as an engine manufacturer, and by 1987 they had secured back-to-back constructors' championships with Williams. But it was their 1988 partnership with McLaren that marked a peak. McLaren, under Ron Dennis, was seeking to regain a technical edge after falling behind Williams in the turbo era. When Honda and Williams fell out due to competitive decisions, McLaren saw an opportunity. We've talked about Ron Dennis before here on Past Gas in our previous iteration of the show. If you listened to that episode back then, you know that Ron Dennis is a very particular man. There's one anecdote of him like washing every rock, every pebble in his like gravel driveway. You know, he's that kind of guy. It really instills a culture of extreme organization and discipline at McLaren, at the McLaren factory. Even today, the McLaren factory is still known for its cleanliness, organization, and like it has sparkling white floors where they build these cars. And I have to imagine the Formula One side of the building even more so. You know, just the most anal retentive racing team in history at this point, under Ron Dennis. So very high standards, which I think plays well with, you know, the Japanese tradition of like, you know, extreme attention to detail and engineering and all that. I can imagine people being let go left and right for not being the good workplace culture fits, you know, for the company. They probably had to separate the wheat from the chaff many times to find the right team in this environment. So let's see how that works out. The McLaren-Honda partnership was formalized in 1988. and represented a convergence of complementary strengths. Honda's engineering dominance and McLaren's operational precision. It also marked a shift in power dynamics within the sport, as the most advanced engine supplier moved from one British elite to another, effectively transferring competitive supremacy with it. Beyond performance, the visual and symbolic implications of the partnership were significant. The McLaren MP4/4, maybe the most recognizable F1 car in history, draped in the iconic Marlboro livery and powered by Honda's RA168E engine, won 15 out of 16 races in 1988. They also led over 97% of all laps raced that season. And with Honda logos on the car, the world was also being reminded of Japan's role and the whole thing. For a sport that was strongly tied to upscale Western European culture, the humble H stood out. And at the center of it all, drivers Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost, both of whom were established elite competitors. But the relationship between the two drivers going into the 1989 season was strained, to put it lightly. Prost had begun to suspect McLaren was treating Senna as their preferred driver in violation of the team's promise to treat both drivers equally. If anything, Prost thought his performance had done enough of the talking. He led the championship for much of the year, and Senna was on the back foot. This is nothing new in Formula One. A lot of these drivers, when you get to a certain point, you really do believe that you are the best, you know, especially this time in Formula One. So anything can easily be construed as sabotage, even though it doesn't really make sense for teams to spend that level of money to sabotage one of their own drivers at the expense of success on their of the team. Like, I can see where he's coming from. Anyway, then came Imola in 1989. Ahead of the race, the two drivers had agreed that whoever led into the first corner would be allowed to win without any fuss. Prost made the better start, took the lead, and held it. Then, a serious crash brought out the red flag, and at the restart, Senna passed Prost. Prost felt the agreement had been broken at that moment, and that a restart signified a different situation entirely. Neither moved an inch from their position, and Senna took the win. After Imola, the two drivers were no longer on speaking terms. They were still teammates, driving the fastest car in the world. But going into the Japanese Grand Prix, they absolutely despised each other. Lap 47 at Suzuka is where it all boiled over. Senna lunged inside of Prost, dive-bombing him at the final pass through the Casio Triangle. Prost, who had publicly declared that he would no longer leave the door open, closed it. The two McLarens collided and slid to a halt. Prost walked away from his car, but Senna urged the marshals to push him back onto the track. They did, and Senna rejoined the race and eventually crossed the finish line in first place. Senna was later disqualified for skipping the chicane where he and Prost initially collided, and Prost walked away with the championship. Hardcore Senna fans will tell you that Prost was being a narc for going to the stewards and telling him that Senna skipped the chicane and thus should be disqualified. Prost fans will tell you that Senna, in fact, skipped the chicane, so he should have been disqualified. And normal people will be like, why are you still arguing over a race that happened 40 years ago? Japanese fans were devastated. Senna was a fan favorite, and watching him get disqualified on Honda's home turf stung in a way that went beyond the sport. The collision at Suzuka Circuit had endured primarily as a defining moment in the rivalry between Senna and Prost. Yet, viewed within a broader context, it also reveals the position Honda had come to occupy in the sport by the close of the decade. Honda did more than just power cars. They had become integral to Formula One's competitive hierarchy. By the early 1990s, it was no longer enough for Japanese cars to be quick. They were now expected to fight for titles. One of the best ways for an OEM to prove their cars are not only fast and competitive, but stout and reliable, is endurance racing. It's the type of motorsport that can make or break a company's reputation and can be intimidating for any manufacturer without the utmost confidence in their platforms. But that didn't scare Mazda. By this point, you're familiar with Mazda, the rotary engine, and of course, the criticism surrounding it. It was too thirsty, too fragile, too unconventional. But out of this came one of the most compelling underdog stories in motorsport history. Mazda Speed first entered Le Mans in 1974, and what followed was an education. One brutal DNF at a time. That means did not finish. Their best result was a 7th place finish in 1987 with the 3-rotor 13G-powered 757. Mazda added another rotor with the 13J engine, which made its way into the 767 race car a few years before it was developed into the now iconic 787B. But before it was the car we all admire today, it suffered the same fate as most rotaries pushed their limits: severe reliability issues. Fun fact, there was no 777 because Mazda considered the 787 a two-step upgrade. Plus, 777 would have been really hard for native Japanese speakers to pronounce. Going into the 1990 24 Hours of Le Mans, Mazda was optimistic. Now powered by the R26B quad-rotor engine, putting down 700 horsepower through a Porsche transmission, the 787 actually had a fair shot, if it didn't break down. In qualifying, the 787 was doing laps at Lasarth 6 seconds faster than the 767. But it wasn't long until the Mazdas started experiencing issues. Of the three 787s, one was leading their class until two wheel hubs seized and the engine eventually failed. The second car's DNF happened in the middle of the night when electrical demons shorted the car's circuits and left it without lights in the dark. Things were looking great for the third and final 787 as their biggest competitors started dropping like flies. By morning, they were the only car left in their class. All they had to do was cross the finish line for a class win. They did, and Mazda won the GTP class, but only after a 90-minute stint in the pits rebuilding the transmission. Although they had won their class and proved they were worthy, they took 20th overall and just barely crossed the finish line. It wasn't the win they wanted, and it didn't instill confidence in their cars. For most of its tenure, the rotary engine was a running joke in the motorsport world. And for what it's worth, it wasn't entirely unfounded. Mazda could have listened to all the criticism. They could have ceded their interest and gone with a more conventional engine design. But instead, they went back to the drawing board following the 1990 season. Mazda's chief of product development demanded another 100 horsepower over the 787's existing output, plus a 10-15% improvement on fuel economy. Those were no small asks. That's the kind of target that gets engineers staring at the ceiling at 2 a.m. But through a massive overhaul featuring more than 80 individual improvements in the engine, including telescoping intake runners and 3 spark plugs per rotor, they managed to find another 70 horsepower in endurance trim, along with what might be the most linear torque curve in racing. Flat foot anywhere from 6,000 to 9,000 RPM, and you had at least 95% of peak torque available. That's crazy, man. You think, like, a lot of V8 engines make peak torque around 3,000 RPM or 4,000 RPM. Especially at that time, like, yeah, it's just wild. At 9,000 RPM making peak torque, that's nuts. Unbridled, the engine could produce 900 horsepower and rev to 10,000 RPM, which resulted in one of the most iconic engine sounds of all time. The The car got bigger wheels, reworked suspension, a slightly longer wheelbase, and extensive wind tunnel testing that reshaped the bodywork with bigger ducts to cool the new carbon brakes. The 787B was all buttoned up and ready to rip. Meanwhile, team boss Takayoshi Ohashi was doing his own kind of engineering. Engineering the rulebook. He persuaded the governing body to allow the 787B to run at 830 kilograms instead of the 1,000 kilograms all the other Group C cars were required to weigh. Hey, yeah, let's make it 175 kilos lighter. That's like 375 pounds. That's a huge advantage. It's like 1.5 meters. Mazda's greatest advantage was something no one could have planned for. Their edge came from the fact that the opposition didn't see Mazda as enough of a threat to even protest. Besides, a regulation change meant that the rotary engine would be banned from competition the following season. This was it. The last shot. And everyone in the Mazda camp knew it. Race day, and the field looked stacked against Mazda. The Sauber Mercedes cars were widely tipped to win. They had speed, reliability, experience, and a driver mod by the name of Michael Schumacher. The 787B qualified 12th, but due to the grid format, started in 19th position. Brutal. Nobody was writing victory speeches just yet. The flag waved and the 59th 24 Hours du Le Mans was underway. Schumacher showed incredible pace until his car was eventually compromised by gearbox issues. Another Mercedes was damaged by debris on the track. The final leading Mercedes, which had led for almost 17 hours, came in with temperatures skyrocketing and never went back out. The Jaguars, Peugeots, Porsches, all of them fell away one by one, punished by exactly the kind of attrition Mazda had spent years quietly preparing for. With just 3 hours to go, Johnny Herbert took the lead in his 787B for the first time and didn't give it back. All three Mazdas entered that year, finished the race. First, sixth, and eighth. And on a post-race inspection, engineers determined the R26B engine was in good enough condition to run another 24 hours. Mazda had finally made a statement. The rotary, the engine nobody believed in, had just outlasted everyone, and in doing so, Mazda had silenced all the criticism. Not only was it the first rotary to win at Le Mans, it was also the first Japanese manufacturer to win the race. And Mazda did it by refusing to stop. Nissan would follow in Mazda's success a year later at the 24 Hours of Daytona. And it's just crazy, given the history of these two manufacturers, if you would have told anyone in Japan in like 1965 that Nissan would follow Mazda's success in any regard, they would have laughed you out of the room. But times have changed. Nissan's R91CP was engineered to operate endlessly, to keep wear within margins that others treated as theoretical. Over a full day and night, it did exactly that. Drama refused and punishment absorbed. Another Japanese champion crowned with an outright victory under their belt. Two other cars that pushed the envelope were Toyota's TS010 and Honda's NSX. Even when results didn't immediately match ambition, the structure of the TS010 signaled the company was taking endurance racing seriously. Their platforms were now being designed to evolve indefinitely, as opposed to just looking like race cars built for one season. The Honda NSX carried this same philosophy. With the great Ayrton Senna involved with testing and development, Honda underscored balance with usability over theatrics. The NSX wasn't called the everyday supercar. It had earned that title after being subjected to an unforgiving feedback loop with non-stop testing at Suzuka and the Nürburgring. Any noise around the vehicles came from the media looking to showcase and exploit their successes. And one of the biggest examples of that came from the world of Australian touring car racing, when a couple of Aussie journalists observed a dominant Nissan Skyline in action.
Thank Thank you to our sponsor, Quo. You ever realize how many customers slip through the cracks? Missed calls, follow-ups that never follow up. It adds up fast, and that's why today's episode is brought to you by Quo, spelled Q-U-O, the business communication system built so you never miss a call. Your entire team can handle calls and texts from one shared phone number, so no more missed messages or dropped conversations. Everyone sees the full thread, replies are faster, and customers actually feel taken care of. Quo works wherever you are, right from your phone or computer. Keep your existing number, add teammates in minutes, sync your CRM, and let the call routing handle itself as you scale. If you own a business that centers around customer service, interfacing with customers or clients, Quo is the one for you. Money's on the line, people. Always say hello with Quo. Try Quo for free, plus get 20% off your first 6 months when you go to quo.com/passedgas. That's quo.com/passedgas. Thank you very much, Quo.
May 6th is National V6 Day, powered by Nissan. V6 Day is an annual celebration of the power, precision, and balanced performance of V6 engines. And Donut is going to be celebrating at Bob's Big Boy. We'll have a bunch of Nissan V6s, but any vehicle with a V6 engine is welcome. Come to Bob's Big Boy in Burbank on May 6th, meet Donut Host, and grab some exclusive merch. There'll be giveaways, games, music, and cars. Don't miss out. It's V6 Day powered by Nissan at Bob's Big Boy in Burbank from 6 to 9 p.m. on May 6th. We'll see you there.
When deciding what the cover story was going to be for Australian car mag Wheels Magazine's July 1989 issue, writer Angus McKenzie and his editor Phil Scott tossed around some ideas for the sake of posterity. But the answer was obvious. They knew they'd be foolish not to feature the Nissan R32 Skyline GTR, as it was the obvious choice. High-tech, headline-worthy, and arriving with a chip on its shoulder. We all know the legends now, but when the Nissan R32 Skyline GTR debuted in 1989, it wasn't like the world stopped spinning. On the surface, it looked to be just another Skyline in a lineage that had always mattered deeply in Japan and only occasionally registered elsewhere. But there was something different with this car, not in its intent, but in its readiness. The R32 was rolled out as a complete, ready-to-rip beast. One that had been engineered to showcase a level of performance that many assume would be pushed without mercy almost immediately. Australia became one of the first places to put that assumption to the test. By the end of the 1980s, the Australian Touring Car Championship had a reputation for one thing: eating posers alive. There, the cars were fast, the grids were tight, and the benchmark was loud and clear. Ford's Sierra Cosworth, with its close-set eyes and giant whale tail, had spent years establishing itself as a reference point for what modern Group A touring could and should be. It was turbocharged, well understood, and known for being devastatingly effective in the right hands. Dick Johnson used it to dominate the ATCC, while the Sierra's twin-turbo RS500 variant turned Bathurst into a warning shot rather than a contest. Ford was pulling gaps so large they felt like hate crimes, which meant that the bar had pretty much been set, and if a new contender wanted a shot at legitimacy, they'd have to be able to measure itself up against the mighty Sierra first. Nissan understood this, but more importantly, they understood that if they were going to beat the Cosworth consistently, the GTR would have to be something more than a clever homologation. It would need to be completely rethought at the most basic level. The Skyline GTR is a race car for the street. It's a race car that happens to be street legal and somewhat comfortable. That process saw race weekends sidelined for dyno pulls, a constant string of negotiations with the Confederation of Australian Motorsport and the FIA. Every performance gain Nissan wanted on track had to survive scrutiny on paper first. And you best believe every component was questioned. Every production number verified. If a part didn't officially exist on the road car, it didn't exist at all. This forced everyone involved to work in tandem. all hands were on deck as they walked the fine line between innovation and legality. And for anyone wondering, this was no easy task. At one point, an engine under precise development was pushed so hard on the dyno that the block cracked. The solution to this problem, however, was not to back off. It was to design and cast stronger engine blocks for the next time around, as things could always be improved, no matter what. It would be this kind of response, seen by many as immediate, expensive, and unapologetic, that would define the legacy left behind by the entire program. Nissan was now treating money as a variable. Their battle to meet regulations needed to be worth it. Here is where Angus McKenzie and Phil Scott from Wheels Magazine return. After Nissan basically asked for the Sierra Cosworth's head, politely of course, while their engineering team addressed finishing touches behind the scenes, the Australian public was encountering the GTR through a very different lens. The summer of 89 saw Wheels Magazine slap the new and improved Skyline on the cover, with a little bit of showbiz-esque touching up, of course. The original photograph given to them to use by Nissan featured the car dipped in a subdued dark gray. Both McKenzie and Scott mutually agreed that this just wouldn't do. We're talking about the front of a magazine, for Christ's sake. It needs to jump off the magazine rack. Something louder was deserved, something that would match Nissan's boldness, their effort to shake things up in the automotive world. So what did they do? Well, they retouched the photo by hand, the image was recolored, altered, to now present the Skyline in bright red. If you're able to get your hands on a copy, look closely, and you'll see the color of the window trim and even the black element behind the rear quarter window glass were changed to red during this process. The money and time weren't there to fix something so subtle, so they left it in. The funny thing about this was, this red was a color Nissan would never offer the Skyline in. Just another example of media magic, baby. The headline Wheels Magazine added to the cover read simply, "Skyline Supercar." Gets the point across, right? Well, the duo still felt something was missing. They didn't want people to gloss over how cool this really was. It needed to jump right off the page. So, to highlight the significance in the spread, Angus McKenzie searched for a word that matched what the car felt like. A fan of old Japanese films, he landed on the word obakemono, or monster, feeling that, at the very least, it would be an eye-catcher. Phil Scott thought this was a joke. He'd scribble a note in the margin saying, "What, like Godzilla?" The joke stuck. Then, like Godzilla, it escaped its containment and made its way into the real world. What McKenzie and Scott didn't realize, though I'm sure they hoped for, is that the Skyline GTR would put up numbers that made its nickname almost seem like an undersell. Piloted by Jim Richards, the GTR entered its first full ATCC season in 1990, and immediately made its presence felt. The Sierra Cosworth was dethroned, and Richards secured his third championship here, running both the new R32 GTR and its predecessor, the HR31 GTSR, gave Nissan a real-time feedback loop. This meant two cars in the same conditions. By 1991 and 1992, the data had done its job. It would be around this time that the Australian press straightened up. The Skyline's nickname quickly went from a playful shorthand to a proper noun. Godzilla was no longer a metaphor. From there, it would be a way to explain why a car from Japan was absolutely crushing a championship that had been built around parity and balance. It became a name that carried an edge of resentment as well as awe. Rally became a place where the shift was undeniable. Not because it was glamorous, not because it rewarded flash, but because it was unforgiving in a way that very few motorsport disciplines could be. With rally racing, all that matters is whether a car can survive snow one day, gravel the next, and tarmac the day after.
On top of it all, a driver was expected to hold it together at all times. And you didn't load the car on a trailer when you were done. You had to drive it on public roads to the next stage. Yeah, rally is brutal. I have never done like a proper rally race, but we built our Subaru to do some rally cross. That was a lot of fun. But while you're doing that, between that experience and then doing Baja, imagining those two together at the same time, I'm kind of like, I don't know if I'm made for that. I don't think I'd enjoy it. It's just, it's a lot. It takes like a certain kind of mindset. Japan's history with rally didn't start in the 90s. It just happened to be the period where things really started to take shape. In 1957, a lone Toyota Toyopet Crown crossed the finish line of the grueling 14,500-kilometer Round Australia trial in 47th place overall, which made Toyota the first Japanese car manufacturer to compete in international motorsport. The following year, Nissan showed up too, entering the Round Australia trial in a Datsun 1000. From there, Nissan quietly got to work. Their Nissan Bluebird 1600 SSS won the East African Safari Rally in 1970, the first time a domestic Japanese car had achieved that feat. It had taken Nissan 7 years of attempts since their first safari go-around back in 1963. The Bluebird SSSR continued to be a constant in rally programs well into the late 80s, viewed by many as an absolute workhorse. Toyota, meanwhile, spent their early days learning how to build a proper rally weapon. The Celica took 3 straight safari wins from 1984 to 1986, before the engineers went back and spit out the legendary Celica GT4, the first Japanese all-wheel drive turbocharged car to enter the WRC. And what was Subaru's answer to all of this? A car that looked like it had no business being there. Subaru debuted the Impreza WRX in 1992. This flat-4 powered grocery getter looked vanilla compared to Group B homologation cars that dominated the rally scene a decade earlier. For reference, this was an era that saw rally cars stretched and swollen into caricatures of performance. These were box-flared monsters like the Audi Quattro S1 with stacked wings and shovel-nose aero. Or the Peugeot 205 T16 that crouched low and were mid-engine like a supercar in disguise. And don't forget the Lancia Delta S4. All vents, scoops, a total menace as if designed by airflow itself. These Group B cars looked fast standing still. They were theatrical by necessity, built to intimidate crowds before the stopwatch even started. But none of this is how you describe a Subaru. While all that was happening, they were more focused on standardizing all-wheel drive across their road cars, poking at the market a little bit by selling durability in cold climates. And don't get me wrong, their rally efforts existed, but they were found in machines like the Subaru Leon RX Turbo, which competed in smaller programs. But underneath the WRX's average Joe appearance, it was a foundation so brutally coherent, people felt like they were being catfished in reverse. Imagine an explosive turbocharged flat four, symmetrical all-wheel drive, and a chassis that seemed to communicate directly with the road no matter how broken or unpredictable that road happened to be. If you recall, Subaru's parent company, Fuji Heavy Industries, came from an aerospace and industrial background, not grand touring lineage, which meant their engineers were already thinking in terms of balance, symmetry, and stress paths. This mindset showed up everywhere, especially its flat four engine that kept mass low and centered. Now, imagine all that in the hands of a crazy Scot named Colin McRae. Colin wasn't engineered in a boardroom or groomed by a factory pipeline. He grew up inside rally culture, raised by the noise and danger of it. His father, Jimmy McRae, was already a legend in British rallying, which meant Colin learned the sport on narrow roads in bad weather. Colin drove with instinct. He came up through national championships in the late 80s and 90s with a style that made team managers nervous and spectators lean forward. Subaru noticed that instinct early. When McRae was brought into their World Rally program, he was raw. And they liked that. Like cocaine straight from Bolivia, the Impreza WRX didn't need a driver who tiptoed. It needed someone who was willing to lean on the car completely. Someone who'd be able to hold it together under abuse. Colin was that person. With him behind the wheel, the WRX became the perfect combination of fast and fearless. Many of those who'd watched Colin race, or were unfortunate enough to have to race against him, would often say how he drove the Impreza like it could take anything. And that's because, for the most part, it actually could. That confidence carried forward through drivers like Richard Burns and Petter Solberg, and between 1995 and 1997, Subaru locked down three consecutive manufacturer's titles. This was a three-peat that couldn't be defined by any single condition. It was the result of competence on the entire team. Mitsubishi, on the other hand, had a response of their own many would consider relentless. The Lancer Evolution. Each iteration was a rolling update, a constant refinement cycle that assumed the car would be punished on the circuit if engineers didn't plan accordingly. Differentials were recalibrated to react faster and more intuitively to change grip. Suspension geometry was dialed in bit by bit. Turbos were resized and boost curves reshaped to deliver usable power instead of unpredictability. Nothing was for show. Every change, whether it be the enhanced cooling systems or brake packages, was done to make the Evo last longer. The car was dialed. It just needed the right driver. Enter one Tommi Mäkinen. Coming up in Finland in the late 80s, Mäkinen followed a classic Nordic path that would lead him right to Mitsubishi. Because that's what you think of when you think of Finland. You think Mitsubishi. Think icy forest roads, local championships, and cars that rewarded precision over flair. He'd cut his teeth with the Opel Kadett GSI, often as a privateer or semi-supported driver, where his exceptional sensitivity to grip made it seem as if he was just going through the motions. His 1994 campaign was one that caught the eye of Mitsubishi. That year, he'd not only win Rally Finland, but the British Rally Championship as well. So when it came down to deciding who'd be the right guy to put their hard work to the test, Mäkinen stood out. He hadn't secured any major sponsorships like he'd hoped, so Mitsubishi swooped in and made it happen. And if you thought Subaru's three-peat was nice, try four straight Mäkinen driver titles from 1996 to 1999. And he made it look easy. Snowbanks, ruts, broken suspension components, none of it was enough to disrupt Mäkinen and the underlying brilliance of the Lancer Evolution. The established rally powers such as Lancia, Ford, Peugeot, names that had defined rally for decades, were unsettled by how calmly these smaller Japanese manufacturers were trouncing on their territory. European firms like ProDrive, already working closely with Subaru's rally efforts, suggested that the rest of the automotive world at large was really starting to see untapped potential in Japanese engineering. Not to mention the way Japan has traditionally handled its successes with poise and class. There was no sense of novelty being displayed, no bombastic declarations being made after victories. The vehicles were there to speak for themselves, and Subaru and Mitsubishi behaved as though this level of performance was simply the outcome of doing the work correctly, which it was. Aside from Colin McRae rolling his car at the X Games. Everything covered so far throughout this series has led to a moment in time where Japan had really made itself known. Through rally, the Japanese proved their adaptability. Through touring, they had proven dominance. Success in the endurance field shut up the haters, answering the last serious question anyone could ask of these machines: whether they had what it took to go the distance. Let's just take a second and marvel at what Japan had accomplished up to this point. It's truly impressive considering that none of it was reliant on a single upset or miracle run. Instead, they just consistently held court,
threading a needle across multiple disciplines, continents, and conditions until denial stopped being a useful go-to. It's also important to note that this isn't just a measure of championships. Plenty of nations had won races before. It'd be a little patronizing for us to sit here and be like, oh, good for Japan, we're so proud of you, given how late you were to the party, that's so impressive. That's not what this is. Japan had literally turned everything upside down, and they did so with little to no interest in shocking the world and retreating. Consistency, precision, and improvement for the sake of progression was all that mattered. What's interesting is how often the story of Japanese motorsport supremacy is flattened into a tale of surprise. The casual car enthusiast might tell you how they were these outsiders who upset tradition, then vanished or sold out once the establishment adapted. Now, whether you believe that to be true or not, there's one thing that should be made clear here. Everything that had happened going into the 1990s wasn't the product of good improvisational skills. It was the execution of a long arc that was carefully funded, tested, and refined for years. That distinction matters because it reframes everything that is about to follow. Guys, starting something new is pretty terrifying. A lot of work goes into your new project that you're not entirely sure is going to work out. It can be hard to make that leap of faith. Like, what if nobody likes my product? What if nobody wants to hear my voice? What if nobody wants to buy anything from me? Well, that's where this week's sponsor, Shopify, comes into play. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US. They handle everybody from giant brands to brands just getting started. And getting started with your own design studio is super easy. They've got hundreds of ready-to-use templates. Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store that matches your brand style. And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. They make it super easy. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/gas. That's shopify.com/gas. Again, shopify.com/gas. Thanks, Shopify. Big thanks to our sponsor, Blue Chew. The future of erectile function is here, fellas. Blue Chew Gold is changing the way millions of men are having sex in 2026. The new arousal-boosting formula combines passion and performance into one tablet that dissolves under your tongue for super-fast onset. No more waiting for a pill to kick in. No more moments ruined by performance anxiety. Just the results you want, when you want them. Most ED meds only focus on blood flow, but Blue Chew Gold goes further by combining two ingredients for blood flow with two for mental arousal and connection. So you're not just physically ready, you are actually in the mood. This type of innovation is why Blue Chew Gold is the number one brand in erectile function. The process is simple and all online. Get started today at bluechew.com and go for gold. Discover your options at bluechew.com. We've got a special deal for our listeners. Right now, when you buy 2 months of Blue Chew Gold, you get a third for free with promo code PASTGAS. That's promo code PASTGAS, guys. Visit bluechew.com for more details and important safety information. And we thank Blue Chew for sponsoring this podcast. Thanks, Blue Chew. Japan's bubble years are usually remembered as a time of excess with a very specific texture. Cities glowed. Tokyo seemed to be permanently awake, lit by neon and confidence in equal measure. Money moved fast and optimism moved faster. Salarymen worked publishing hours, then spent just as aggressively, pouring into late-night bars and karaoke rooms. As we've discussed, Japan's automotive industry treated the bubble as the insulation it claimed to be. Space was created within it, aiding not only the financial situations of various manufacturers, but also the way they psychologically went about organizing their business, as well as the pursuit of ideas that demanded patience. One example is Nissan's Atezza ETS all-wheel drive system, built to solve problems most drivers would never encounter. This required time, time to explore all the variables and make sure none were ignored. Which explains why Japanese racing efforts of the era feel so fundamentally special compared to their peers. Engineers were given the green light to overbuild a little bit, or in some cases, a lot, without being asked to justify every gram of material or every hour on the dyno. Imagine someone giving you a budget to pursue whatever your passion is and then saying, "See what's possible." It's hard to believe that anyone in the creative sphere wouldn't give their left arm to be in a similar situation. Even the skeptics would at very least want to see what it's all about. In a time where redundancy was seen as responsible instead of wasteful, where failures weren't underwritten as losses but learning moments, putting four wheels on the ground and moving forward could only be described as progress. This was Japan adapting, and the wins they accumulated along the way were just proof of that. But let's not pretend that Japan was completely disinterested in success. History is written by the winners, and no one understood that more than Japan. All the success accumulated across the 1990s, none of that happened accidentally. It required a very specific type of confidence, one made stronger by the fact that resources will still be there next season, that today's investment won't be questioned tomorrow. For a moment there, the bubble provided that. But as we've been alluding to, those bubbles don't last. Many were warned to make good while you could. These amazing conditions that had enabled this outward surge into abundance were soon to tighten. When the yen started to strengthen, export economics shifted with it. Those who had grown accustomed to having room to stretch, the ability to throw stuff at the wall, were now being greeted by the unfriendly sight of men in suits, the kind that dish internal scrutiny through memorandums and progress reports, bean counters. Racing departments that had once been allowed to operate as long-term research arms now had to explain why they'd built an entire backup system for a problem that only existed in the margins of a test report. A collapse, however, was not something Japan was willing to endure. The very idea of suddenly withdrawing or retreating in embarrassment sent a collective chill down the backs of Japanese manufacturers. Fortunately for them, they had done so much to push things forward that time was bought to figure things out. For context, almost the entire time Japan was making its way around the globe filling up their trophy cases, the country was in what many have called the beginning of the lost decade. And that was exactly the problem Japan was beginning to face. Just when their ability to export began to narrow, the world's desire to receive what they had built expanded dramatically. Selling a grand narrative along with a victory would become increasingly difficult during what would otherwise be described as a triumphant time. Japanese cars would show up, run their programs, more than likely dominate, and then leave. Any interpretation beyond that was left almost entirely up to the spectator, the outsider looking in, who'd nudge their buddy and go, "What's up with those guys?" Thus, a vacuum was created, and it would prove to be powerful. You see, when access is easy, interest stays casual. But when access tightens, when cars are tagged as rare, homologation specials unattainable, or entire model lines completely forbidden due to regulation, fascination can only do one thing.
Intensify!
On the next episode of Pass Gas, fascination becomes obsession. While Japan continues to conquer the world, people start scheming, restrictions are made, and rules are broken. My name is Nolan Sykes. Thank you so much for listening. Big thank you to Joe Weber sitting across from me. Making sure I sound good. Big thanks to our editor, Mark Schroeder. We got our writers, Anthony Harden, Greg Nix, Audrey Holden, and thanks to you for listening. If you're not already subscribed, you can subscribe to Pass Gas and all of our other fine podcasts on the platforms of your choice. Check out Talk Talk Nation with Joe, where he interviews very interesting people across the car industry, and Jimmy Eats Cars. Jimmy Hilton,
talking car news in a way that only Jimmy could. Truly. If you want to see our faces in those shows, subscribe to Donut Podcasts on YouTube. It's Donut Podcast, baby. We're doing it. All right. Bye.